Hey, this is Cedric Youngelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. Before we get into this very special episode with Morad Mahmoudov on the ultimate case for Bitcoin, I'd love to share a few words about our sponsors. CipherSafe has a long heritage of creating quality and beautiful metal products. Their parent company, Numberall, has been doing it since 1930. With Bitcoin slowly changing people's time preference, they feel it's a great time to focus on making artistic metal items. People can again start to appreciate an item for its beauty and the craftsmanship it took to make it. The Bitcoin Rouleau Triangle is a fusion of engineering, geometry, artisanship, and Bitcoin. They achieved a beautiful textured surface for an almost diamond-coated look. I know you'll find the Bitcoin Rouleau Triangle to be as beautiful as I do. CipherSafe also offers a full line of physical stainless steel products to help you protect your Bitcoin from various modes of failure. When you've decided to be your own bank and hold your Bitcoin yourself, it's time to create a physical backup to protect those keys and your Bitcoin. For more information, go to CipherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. What if you didn't have to pay healthcare premiums anymore? What if you could invest in Bitcoin instead? With CrowdHealth, you can put aside money for health expenses in your own account and even hold a large part of it in Bitcoin. If Bitcoin goes up, you get the upside, not big insurance companies. Pay one low monthly total to fund an account that is yours. Choose your doctors, get great healthcare, and hold up to 75% of the balance in Bitcoin every month. If a large expense comes up, CrowdHealth will help negotiate and crowdfund the bill for you. Stop supporting the broken health insurance system with your hard-earned capital. Right now, you can get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's just a fraction of high-deductible insurance plans. Go to joincrowdhealth.com and use code MATRIX now and experience freedom from health insurance by utilizing Bitcoin. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. As always, thank you for listening. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Morad.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Morad Mahmoudov, aka Must Stop Morad, on Twitter, is the founder of STFX, an economist, angel investor, and one of the highest conviction Bitcoin maximalists in the world. Morad believes that Bitcoin will transform finance, government, and society, and due to its deflationary properties, will cause people to think more long-term relative to how people act in the current fiat money system. Morad, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is a real feather in my cap in a lot of ways. Your appearance on Pomp about four years ago really crystallized a lot about Bitcoin for me at a really key moment in my journey. And I really think it kind of was a fork in my path around, trying to get my head around crypto and what this thing could mean and becoming a Bitcoin maximalist. So I'm excited to chat with you and kind of get into this. But first, can you tell me a little bit more about you and your background?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm originally was born and raised in Azerbaijan to an Azerbaijani dad, Ukrainian mother. Kind of lived there until I was 16, 17 years old. Went to university in the United States, studied Chinese language and finance. Lived in China, in Singapore, Beijing, Hong Kong for about a year each, kind of working in traditional finance. And I would say about ever since 2013, 2014 at first, and then more actively kind of 2016 onwards, been involved in Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency space in general, doing numerous sorts of things, kind of writing, investing, analyzing, speaking, building, etc. So that's what I've been focused on.
Yeah, and I think all that's going to lend itself to our conversation today. You know, I think around this time, I think with sort of my market dynamics and macro outlook, I think it's important to kind of get back to the basics a little bit before we get to the bigger vision. So what is Bitcoin to you?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess if you ask 1,000 people, you might get 1,000 slightly different responses. But to me, it is a natural evolution of money and a natural evolution of where money is going to go, inevitably, in my opinion, in the future. I think to understand Bitcoin, you need to understand kind of the history of money and how it evolved from kind of various tally sticks and debt forms into commodity money. And more importantly, I think the period from 1971 up until today, it represents kind of an aberration or almost like a perversion, right? From the natural free market equilibrium, where instead of a money being an emergent, decentralized product of the free market, it is kind of mandated upon us kind of top down instead of emerging bottoms up, right? And so we are being told what is the only like one or the only a few things that we can use as money, rather than it be a free market product, just like our shampoo, just like our food, just like our water, etc. Right. So the hope here is that Bitcoin will end this kind of era of fiat money aberration and return us back more in line with gold, to be something that naturally emerged through history, through the free market, rather than being forced down upon us. And so to me, it's essentially almost like a super gold that is superior to the best commodity money we've had for fiat money emerged, and the one that can truly natively work in the digital era, in the era of the internet.
Yeah.
So I would say in one sentence, to me, Bitcoin represents the future of money, essentially.
Yep. Future of money. There's a lot to unpack there. Like what you said about free market and so being a product and super gold. And if I want to get a little bit later into the fiat aberration since 1971, but we are in the digital era. And it's not always easy to understand digital money and the future of money. So what are the important components of Bitcoin to you?
Yeah. So I would say, in my opinion, the genius of Satoshi was how he managed to combine sort of different parts of technology and different disciplines in order to make Bitcoin happen. It very beautifully sits at the intersection of, obviously, Adam's back invention of Hashcash, several kind of cryptographic primitives, obviously timestamping servers, but most beautifully, in my opinion, is his ingenuity in adding the difficulty adjustment aspect of it. And so it's precisely the difficulty adjustment factor that is kind of intricately connected to Bitcoin being able to stay very rigid to its disinflationary design. And so I would say, yeah, those are, so the latter is definitely the most ingenious piece of the equation in my mind.
Right. There's a lot of components, and we'll get into a little bit of that. You mentioned time stamping, and I wonder, you know, is this, you know, is just a currency on a blockchain? How important is the blockchain here?
So the blockchain is super important, obviously. And I would say, obviously, it is a form of a ledger. And I believe that Satoshi himself originally referred to the concept as a time chain rather than a blockchain in some of the early kind of Bitcoin talk forums. and some of his other posts and stuff like that. The blockchain is obviously super important because the system is designed in a way where essentially the deeper a certain transaction goes back in time, so the longer your transaction has been a part of the canonical chain, kind of the less anxiety you have to statistically experience regarding sort of its validity, right? And so, yeah, it's very important, obviously.
Yeah. And how did Satoshi, or what was the significance of solving the double spend problem? I mean, this is digital. Can I just copy this, you know, these files and move them around? What sort of comfort do I have there?
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, Bitcoin is probably the first example. So many would say that Bitcoin's greatest technological achievement is its solution to the double spending problem, right? Prior to Bitcoin, in order to solve something like this in a practical manner, kind of users of various financial networks and financial technologies would have to trust a central intermediary, right? Most famously banks, right? In order to decide whether a transaction is legitimate, in order to sort of make sure that no sort of quote unquote double spending occurs, right? Satoshi's genius was being able to create both a payment network and a store of value currency in a way where no trust in a centralized authority is needed, right? And so obviously his manner of solving the double spending problem was one of his greatest geniuses for sure.
Yeah. And this is open source code and software. So what is the governance around this project like?
Yeah, so famously, relative to many other kind of projects in the crypto space, some of which pursue sort of a formal on-chain governance approach where people either vote on things or use their coins to vote on things, and kind of the governance is stake-weighted based on the number of coins that a certain node or a certain wallet owns. Bitcoin follows what people kind of in our industry refer to as an informal governance process. And it's hard to define specifically, but I believe, from what I understand, Bitcoin's governance process mimics some of the best practices of other kind of large open source projects that preceded Bitcoin, in the sense that there are a number of kind of contributors around the world. Usually any kind of formal governance proposal is usually preceded by several months of research or several months of kind of preliminary outline of the idea. Then kind of certain improvement, if the research is deemed valid or useful or receives kind of good feedback. From what I understand, kind of a certain proposals, Bitcoin improvement proposals, are kind of put forward. And depending on kind of the reaction from core contributors and other important members of kind of the Bitcoin related repositories and the Bitcoin core repository, most importantly, the proposal is either implemented or sort of not implemented, right? And that's kind of the general kind of loose informal governance process that Bitcoin follows.
Yeah. So is this like Silicon Valley and dog walking apps and move fast and break things?
Yeah. So super famously, one of Bitcoin developmental philosophies is the importance to move slowly and being extremely careful, because a lot of the kind of the thinkers and the developers in the Bitcoin space believe that this is technology of paramount importance. Obviously, it already underlies hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth, and obviously billions of dollars in transactions. So we must treat it with the same level of carefulness as you would treat something like a surgical software or a nuclear reactor or something like that, right? And therefore, the focus isn't so much on speed, agility, and experimentation, but rather on kind of safety and really sort of evolving slowly and carefully.
Right. You mentioned there like a nuclear reactor. I just did a show about nuclear mining. And it could take, I mean, mostly because of regulations and red tape. I mean, it could take 10, 20 years to build one of these things. But how long of a project is Bitcoin in your mind?
Yeah, so if all goes well, it's a project that should last over 100 years, right? And probably even longer, depending on the evolving kind of nature of monetary dynamics and everything else. But the best case scenario is Bitcoin is a multi-century invention, right? And so precisely because it plans on existing for so long, its time horizon that underlies the decision making must also be very kind of patient and careful as well.
Right. So, I mean, this is software and it's digital and the code is easy to copy, maybe not the units or sort of the measurement of value, but how do these other projects even compete against Bitcoin? What are the trade-offs that they're trying to sort through to even try?
Right. So I guess most famously, Ethereum tries to compete against Bitcoin by sacrificing a little bit of security, I would say, but in favor of more functionality or more utility at the base layer. And I think perhaps a lot of kind of fellow Bitcoin listeners might not agree with me on this point, but I think that the reason why Ethereum has managed to become or achieve like half Bitcoin size or 60% of Bitcoin size at some points in time is precisely because it has allowed a lot more experimentation on top of it, right? Through the use through the ability to be more programmable, it has allowed sort of an entrepreneurial ecosystem to kind of be built on top of it, right? Now, the consensus in the space right now is that the consensus about Bitcoiners is that because Bitcoin is trying to be money, money itself is so important and such a large market and such a large necessity in the human civilization, we shouldn't kind of mix and match and add a lot of other kind of dApps and projects and other sort of secondary or tertiary functionalities right at the same kind of base level, right? And for the longest time, I believed that as well. And I guess there's a long debate about whether store of value or medium of exchange or unit of account, which one of these kind of is more important or which one of these is like a horse driving the carriage? Are they kind of moving together or are they moving kind of pulling against one another, et cetera, right? I think it's fair to say at this point, whether I don't think it's by choice, but more so as an emergent effect, Bitcoin is more following kind of like the store of value path. And even in my own mind, and I kind of recently said this to a friend, and obviously this is a very loose and precise metaphor, but I said that Bitcoin is like reminding me more of as a bond almost, in the sense that it's been growing a little slower, like in the last cycle or two. But whenever I think about all the chaos in the world or all the wars or all the censorship that's happening, even with some of the Ethereum smart contracts and stuff, Bitcoin is like in the crypto space, it's the coin where you store your wealth and you want to go to sleep and you sleep the best, right? It's the thing that gives you the less stress, essentially, right? And lately we are seeing some censorship happen at smart contract level in Ethereum kind of more often, right? We're seeing more addresses being added to various countries' blacklists, to OFAC lists. We're seeing like certain developers get targeted, et cetera, right? And every time something like this happens, it's like, I wanna like transfer even more of my portfolio to Bitcoin, which is already 90% Bitcoin, but I wanna transfer more of my portfolio to Bitcoin because somebody once said that like layer zero is social, right? And at that, and you start comparing the cultures of different coins, and you know that Bitcoin has like this most, and Monero to a lesser extent, but Bitcoin has the most sort of like truly like anarchist, like hardcore open source libertarian ethos. And it's very important in my opinion as well.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. Censorship, social scalability. What I want to key in on a little bit right now, though, is you mentioned war, sleep, stress. And I want to kind of get into more of the comforting aspects of Bitcoin or where that kind of helps it and what you're getting at there. So walk us through the design of Bitcoin, like more the monetary design, the disinflationary and the deflationary nature of Bitcoin.
Right. So Bitcoin is designed in such a way so that its inflation is being halved every 4 years. I might be wrong, but I think that Satoshi has gotten some of the inspiration for this from Nick Szabo's BitGold back in the day. And it's essentially it's a way to kind of synthetically mimic the properties of gold in the digital realm, but arguably in an even more elegant way, right? And so I guess gold has been pretty good, but the problem with it is that you can still mine some when the demand for it really increases, and you can, and like if there is an occasional discovery of gold somewhere in Central Africa or an asteroid brings a bunch of gold, whatever, that will obviously create certain difficulties, right? If the entire global economy is kind of built on that monetary layer, right? In the digital realm, you can define much more rigid and precise parameters and designs. And that's precisely what's going on in Bitcoin. And many people have theorized, and people didn't theorize. I mean, Satoshi himself has discussed this on forums many times as well, but the events of 2008 and 2009 and kind of the bailouts of a lot of kind of traditional banking institutions have definitely been one of the three or four core motivations behind Bitcoin, right? And the idea with its disinflationary design is to create a form of money that central banks effectively cannot continuously steal from you like they currently are doing with fiat money and with kind of through the seigniorage that they essentially receive by essentially having the monopoly on money creation, right? And so the goal with Bitcoin, among other things, is to put an end on some third parties being able to get wealthy at the average people's expense, essentially.
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier before how Bitcoin could be a little bit, you know, sort of like anarchy. And I think maybe a little bit counterculture. And you sort of mentioned how, money creation. And I think we're kind of getting at a euphemism of money printing by governments or, you know, third parties or nation states. So how is, you know, money a product just like any other product?
There are many theories regarding the origins of money, but the one that I personally subscribe to is the fact that money is a naturally emergent product, almost just like everything else that we use in our daily lives. And essentially, obviously, a purely bartering economy is not very efficient. And money is almost like a hyper-liquid good that naturally emerges and is naturally chosen kind of by a certain environment to act as almost like an intermediary hyper-liquid essence to make the economy a lot more efficient and to make the exchange a lot more smooth than if you compare it to a purely barter situation, right? And so depending on kind of the geography that surrounded a certain civilization, different peoples of ancient worlds use different things, right? We know of metals, obviously. We know of agricultural goods. We know of wampum, tobacco. And we know of shells. So many different kind of commodities that have been used as money. One sort of gradually replaced the other based on how difficult it is to find and produce, right? Because essentially, if you're on a deserted island and you use a certain form of money, if another culture arrives who have a large supply of that very thing, then they can essentially rapidly create hyperinflation in your economy, right? So I believe that as trade around the world and as contact between cultures started growing, different of these goods started to compete against one another as well, right? Mm-hmm. Just like societies themselves. And it is unsurprising that by 18th and 19th century, kind of silver and gold emerged as the dominant two winners, with the gold being even more dominant, precisely because of their rarity, low supply, difficulty to produce, and more importantly, difficulty to produce large quantities fast, right? And people have realized that essentially these items keep their value better than all of the other alternatives that I've mentioned. So they naturally evolved as the best sort of the best chemical that exists on Earth for the world, right? Obviously, because it's not very practical to use, representative money emerged, which was essentially money that promised a certain number of grams of gold at a certain institution. And then people used gold less and less and used these promissory notes more and more. Ultimately, by early and middle of 20th century, a lot of the governments have decided to tie their own currencies to the US dollar, which in turn was tied to gold. Hmm. And then famously in 1971, the connection between, or the redemption mechanism between US dollar and gold was severed. So since 1971, the value of the US dollar isn't represented by gold anymore. And other countries have in return have kind of severed their sort of peg to the US dollar, right? So now essentially you have a dollar as well as other sort of six or seven major fiat currencies and kind of a long tail of other ones as well. But essentially each of these isn't really tied to anything other than kind of the government mandate or the government decree, right? There are some schools of thought of monetary economics, such as kind of modern monetary theory and a few others, which believe that the government's kind of ability to tax people and the majority of the population agreeing to be taxed essentially and complying with these laws is the core driver for the demand for fiat money. That's kind of one way of looking at it, right? I believe that honestly is just something that is that like we are forced to use, and essentially the government's monopoly on violence at a large scale is obviously something that is able to kind of cage this elephant in, so to speak, right?
Yeah, really a lot to go over there, especially around. I mean, you mentioned shells and tobacco. And then obviously gold and silver. So the evolution of money and how one replaces the other. So can Bitcoin adopt tech that altcoins are working on? And could any of these altcoins replace Bitcoin?
Interesting question. So I believe that theoretically Bitcoin could adopt a lot of these technologies, but we are probably not going to see anything of the sort in the next 5 or 10 years. Obviously, there is a ton of At least not on the base layer, right? Obviously, there's a ton of growth in Lightning Network and related technologies that we're seeing in the last couple of years in particular. And actually, a few friends of mine are building a DEX, and DEXs are usually things you see on Ethereum and other platforms. But there are people building DEXs and betting apps and other kind of cool apps that you would usually see on Ethereum. They're building it on top of the Lightning Network, right? So my friends are building something called Collider, which is essentially a way to trade perpetual derivatives and futures on top of the Lightning Network, which I think is super cool, right? Yeah. So to answer your question, we're definitely going to see, and people call this like kind of Bitcoin DeFi, right? Some of these things that we've seen on other chains are definitely going to emerge on top of Bitcoin as well, in some shape or form. It's still a little bit early, but we'll see how that evolves. So to answer your question, yes, it's technically possible, but I don't think that neither the Bitcoin developers nor the kind of the core Bitcoin community wants any of that on base layer at the moment.
Right. And what about, could any of these altcoins replace Bitcoin?
You know, that's a difficult question. To be completely honest with you, I would lean to, like, back in 2018, right? When you first heard that podcast of mine, I would put the probability at like a 90% no. And right now I would still say no, but I would put the probability maybe more at like 80%. Just because I think that Bitcoin is definitely better money, but I am truly baffled by how large the market caps have gotten for some of these projects whose underlying currencies are so obviously worse at monetary policy, security, kind of rigidity of governance, etc. And my fear is that like the market is just like doesn't care so much about these first principles. So it almost depends on what happens in the future, right? If like nothing bad happens in the world, and like nothing breaks in those technologies and somehow they manage to stay afloat, then it's theoretically possible. But to answer your question, I still think Bitcoin stays number one for the next decade. But what lies beyond that is anybody's guess.
Yeah, I'm really kind of miffed by how big some of these projects still are in terms of market cap. I tend to think of it as a result of inflation or really just money printing and sort of money sloshing around the system chasing alpha. And I think a lot of people, even institutions, are sort of driven to gamble in these markets. Yeah. I think maybe retail out of sort of desperation. I hate to use that word, but it's not really, I think institutional out of either being able to dump on retail, but also they need to get alpha somewhere, an extreme alpha. And, I don't know about the long-term prospects for any of these projects, but I do think that we'll see cycles and waves maybe of other sort of projects and trends bubbling up until things break, at least.
So I definitely agree with you. And a lot of kind of anthropologists and historians always say that whenever we approach the decade of a monetary reset or like a financial reset, people gravitate towards like gambling, leverage, lottery tickets, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Because when people experience stress, anxiety, when the times are bad, they want to cling onto hope, right? Or they want to find something, even if the odds are one in a trillion, there being a non-zero chance essentially like adds this sort of glimmer of hope or some meaning in people's lives, right? And essentially, inflation causes people to gamble, to put it in one line, right? So I definitely agree with you there. And that could be an explainer for why some of these altcoin market caps have gotten so big. But the kind of the other explanation here is because those other chains have more dApps, essentially, they can get a regular person on the street who wants to be the end user of those dApps, whether it's a game, a betting platform, or something else. It creates the intermediary demand for that random person who that has never heard about crypto at all to first buy whatever that chain's coin is so that they could then buy that NFT, right? And so essentially, it's that like medium of exchange comes first theory that I alluded to before. And so that person who just wants to gamble on cards, they don't care about the rigidity of monetary supply or anything like that, right? And so what ends up happening is they invest $1,000 into that coin, 900 of it goes to buying whatever card they want to buy, and then that $100 stays as the store of value component in their wallet, right? And that drives the market cap, you know what I mean? So, I mean, to hardcore Bitcoin maximalists, I might be sounding like a shitcoiner right now, but I'm just kind of explaining like some other forces at play as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have these dialogues and trying to understand what's going on here. I do think that a lot of asset classes have been historically monetized since 1971. I think people are trying to find store value. I think MOE is also a very interesting aspect of our lives right now. A lot of our life is about payments, whether it's Venmo, PayPal, what Strike's trying to do, what Lightning's trying to do. But in terms of asset classes then, because I think, like I just said, a lot of these classes, these assets have been monetized. So where are these asset classes now in terms of maybe, in your opinion, being monetized as a store of value? And where is Bitcoin in relation to real estate, bonds, equities, and where do you see Bitcoin in the future compared to those asset classes? And I guess because we're talking about crypto here, do you think Bitcoin is winner take all or more of a Pareto 80-20 and further on?
So essentially, there's an old Jewish proverb which goes, a man should put a third of his money into land, a third of his money into gold, and a third of his money into his business, right? And essentially, the fact that we live in what I call a slow hyperinflation, right, with fiat constantly eroding and arguably particularly fast in the last 2-3 years, like you said, it forces people to gamble, right? And because of the constant erosion of fiat, people are almost like kind of like pushed at the edge of the waterfall, right? They're pushed towards investing in other financial classes, right? Bonds and stocks, famously, but also real estate. A lot of like weird alternative stuff is emerging. Obviously, like Beanie Babies, you could say NFTs in the last couple of years, artwork, wine sellers. There's so many different things that people are trying to find some kind of outperformance in these days, right? The problem is that like money is not supposed to be like this complex. And essentially, the problem with fiat money is it's not making it easy for people to save, right? If you want to be a painter or a perfume artist or a surgeon or a barber, it doesn't matter who you are. You want to focus on your craft. You want to figure out how to get better at your craft. And you want to, when you receive your monthly salary, let's say you spend 70% of it, you want to have some kind of a vehicle, some kind of a medium, some kind of like a box where you can save the fruits of your labor because you don't need to spend so much today. And so that you can accumulate somewhere for the future, right? The nature of fiat money is such that they almost like deliberately make that very difficult to do. And they almost push you to go gamble on stocks or invest in indices or find financial advisors or invest in this or invest in that or go try to become a day trader, et cetera, right? Mm. And this is bad, right? Essentially, this is forcing everybody to kind of be constantly be on the lookout for these lottery tickets. It's definitely increasing stress in society. I actually think it's like one of the top three contributors to a lot of like the weird stuff going in the world right now. And essentially the savers are like the people who benefit from this benefit at the expense of the savers, right? Collectively speaking, right? And my belief is that if we return to a gold-like system, which Bitcoin definitely fits that bill, then money that flowed into residential real estate, commercial real estate, maybe even artwork itself, obviously stocks, bonds, and many different other kinds of things would flow back into the natural savings vehicle, right? It's like one of my friends said a couple of weeks back, he said, the market is like desperately crying for a functional savings vehicle, right? And that's what we don't have. That's what we lack. And a lot of kind of the Bitcoin philosophers, they've speculated that because of these inflationary pressures, people are focused on short-termist stuff, right? How can I just like quickly hustle and get some money in a week? How can I like scam somebody in 2 weeks, right? How can I just get some money for these noodles today, right? That's what people are thinking. But the idea is that the greatest achievements of humankind, they come when men and women decide to work on something for 10 years, 20 years even, right? Because no great thing in the world, no great achievement of man can be achieved in 1 hour, right? It's just not possible. And so inflation essentially changes the chemical balance on a macroeconomic level of society so that they focus on short-term stuff rather than what happens 20 years from today. And people believe that if we return to a more sort of a hard money standard, then people's emotional predispositions would change more towards kind of a long-termist project.
Yeah. So then if you have a low time preference, how big is this opportunity in our lifetime?
So if you believe Bitcoin is going to be the winner or the predominant winner, then we are talking like something to the tune of $100 trillion or more, right? And essentially, there's 100x left in this. So if Bitcoin wins and fiat loses, then very bluntly speaking, there's 100x more upside from here.
And do you think all fiat currencies will fiat currencies survive, or will they all collapse?
Fiat currencies will definitely collapse. I think there's no question there, because I think that if you study the history of the world, then essentially all attempts at fiat-like money, or all attempts at manipulating the currency, or all attempts at reducing kind of the copper, bronze, and gold content in coins, and all the early fiat experiments with ancient China and all of that, all of them collapsed, right? There's been no such thing as like a fiat money that successfully stays in one form for centuries. Due to fiat's money nature, it needs constant expansion, right? And if we don't colonize space like tomorrow, which is probably not happening, then the fiat money is going to reach a boiling point. Now, 2021, was that the boiling point? Probably not. We probably have one or two more pops left before like the whole system implodes, right? But it's definitely going to happen. And my kids are going to be even more internet native. The grandkids are going to be even more internet native than that. And to them, coupled with all the MMORPGs and all of the digital native stuff that they're playing and using, etc., it's going to be completely natural to be using these like almost like sci-fi credits and digital currencies, etc., rather than like having to go to the bank or having to use a password in an archaic Web2 portal or anything like that, right? And yeah, so I think fiat money is definitely going to go away. Whether that happens like gently or violently, TBD, right? But I definitely think that cryptocurrencies are going to dominate 100%.
And do you think Bitcoin is going to become global money?
As it currently stands, it has the highest probabilities of becoming the dominant number one global currency in the future. Now, as to whether it's going to be winner take all, I'm not sure, because if we lived in like a perfect computer simulation utopia with like computer agents, etc., it would quickly trend towards winner take all. But I think because of like the frictions and the chaos that still exists in reality, it's probably going to be more like three or four, like each progressively smaller than the other. So I think for the time being, that's probably going to be the status quo.
Sure. And let's kind of take a look a little bit at, you know, sort of what the detractors might think. And I'll throw some questions at you. Can Bitcoin go to zero?
I think Bitcoin going to zero is extremely unlikely. I think that there are stronger and stronger price supports, kind of the lower you go. Naturally, there are only so many sellers that can come in at any given cycle. Obviously, we need to consider the fact that from its inception up until last year, Bitcoin has only known, loosely speaking, kind of expansionary monetary policies, quantitative easing, and a decade of the stock bull market, right? All of these have contributed to its success, whether you view Bitcoin as a monetary expansion hedge or beta, like a tech stock, whatever. Obviously, all of these trends have benefited it. So these things are definitely important to consider. But no, it's not going to zero in the next 50 years, for sure.
If it did go to zero, what would be the most likely reason?
Like a catastrophic bug in the code base, but even that would probably be quickly patched at the social layer. As I believe we've seen a couple of small incidences of that, or like super early on in Bitcoin's existence. There's just very difficult to see it going to zero. I mean, in a doom case scenario, it could go like to 10,000, under 10,000 or whatever. That's still possible, but I don't think it's going to zero anytime soon.
Sure.
And I mean, the amount of like wallets and users and global believers have all been growing steadily for the past decade. So as those increase, so does the kind of the minimum buy hard support level that's kind of underneath current price as well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think it's going to zero. I think if we did have a catastrophic bug, I think, you know, worst case scenario there, we'd probably have to do some sort of UTXO transfer. And in that case, you're still not going to zero. What about trust and market cap? Are those different or are those the same?
Super loosely speaking, in the long term, I believe that market cap kind of represents the collective trust in that asset's usage as a store of value, right? So obviously Bitcoin is still like early on, so every like dollar that comes in probably boosts the market cap by more than $1, probably boosts it by like 4 to 7x or whatever. Ultimately market cap represents kind of like the collective desire to park money in that asset, right? So yes, I think it's fair to say that market cap and trust kind of mirror each other quite well.
What about Bitcoin can't be money because no political entity backs it?
That's a good question. So I guess that's a very fiat question. That's a very fiat nature question. But essentially, that question betrays an asker's fundamental misunderstanding of what makes money valuable. And these people believe that money is valued only because the government said that. I believe that's called the Chartalist school of thought in money, in kind of monetary economics. But I'm strongly believe that it is completely wrong. And it's not the money, it's not the government that defines what money is, but it's rather social consensus or what the people decide to use as medium of exchange and store of value. Now, we do currently live in an era where these two things coincide, where we are using more so as a medium of exchange and unit of account than store of value, but people use it as a store of value also, obviously. The same thing that government mandates, but I believe that the system is unsustainable and will be replaced by a superior alternative. So no, the government doesn't need to back something for it to be useful, because the gold and metals became money long before large kind of empires and central banks and large commercial banks existed.
Yeah, I find that's one of the hardest ones to deal with when someone throws it at me. It happened to me last night. My 80-year-old neighbor threw that at me, and it's very fiat mindset. And so there's not a lot of conversation there when someone's coming at you with that particular, but it's a tough one. I like the way you handle it.
I personally think the environment stuff is more difficult because it's a very nuanced thing, right? And we have seen more and more research that proof of work mining actually encourages the development of sustainable energy generation, right? But the people, like 99% of people, they don't care about nuance. They don't care about like long chain of logical thought. They don't care about digging in, sitting down and taking 45 minutes to like carefully think about issues and second order, third order effects, right? All they care about is, oh, like the machine takes energy, so it's like bad for the trees, right? And people don't want to read behind the headline. Now, on top of that, it's very easy to weaponize the ESG people, the people who don't want Bitcoin to grow, the people who want the current system to persist. Very easy to weaponize some of these things against Bitcoin again and again and again. And I believe that these propaganda attacks will intensify.
Yeah.
Especially as fiat is weakening, you know? So
definitely I agree. I definitely think they're going to intensify. I think especially since the merge and proof of stake versus proof of work. And I though find that the energy one, I tend to have a little bit more better time with people, I guess, when you're trying to orange pill, because 5 out of 10 people are never going to change their mind if they come in with sort of, I'm talking about when they come up with these attitudes about ESG or fiat sort of political entity needs to back the money. But with the fiat thing, like, I think a lot of people who have that sort of view, 10 out of 10 are hard to convince, because they're like, you can't tell me nothing about money. I've grown up with fiat my whole life, and that's how money works. With energy, half of them will admit they don't know anything about energy, and that they're just repeating something, and it's not as touchy because you're not talking about money, and you're not saying that they don't know how to work money or something. It's just, and if you mention flared methane, like, you kind of get about half of them to be like, huh, tell me more. I don't know what the hell you're talking about, at least in sort of my experience. But I want to move on to the next sort of detractor. Is Bitcoin too volatile to be a store of value?
No, I don't think so. And actually, my belief is that if you study, so the thing about money and commodity money in particular is that it actually predates written history, right? So it's very difficult to find first sources about how some of these things emerged. But my belief is that all of the examples of past commodity money that I've given, in their early years of becoming the dominant money in that like village, city, country, county, whatever, like their respective prices relative to other goods were almost definitely volatile as well. Right. So the process of monetization and the process of maturation is bound to be volatile, right? The end goal for any global money is to be worth like 100, 200 trillion dollars in today's terms, right? And obviously, you can't go from zero to 100 trillion without, like, in a straight line or immediately get there in one, like, poof, right? It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be volatile. And actually, I think of these like boom and busts that Bitcoin cycle, that Bitcoin price chart has, almost like as heartbeats, and almost like a tree that like keeps growing like taller and taller, right? And like a thunderstorm might cut off a few like sticks or whatever, but it is going to grow them back, right? And the time it, whenever it grows them back, it grows them stronger than it was before the thunder hit, right? So essentially, no, like the volatility is, first of all, has been predominantly to the upside over the medium and long term over the past 11 years. Second of all, like the volatility is literally an opportunity to ride the trend of one money being monetized at the expense of another and actually benefit, right? So no, it's impossible for a new money to emerge without volatility. So to answer the question, no, it's completely fine.
Yeah. And what about Bitcoin can't scale to be global money?
So obviously you are not going to be using like Bitcoin layer one to pay for like candy at the store in the future, right? You're not. The future payments will happen on like layer two, maybe even layer three, layer four, whatever it's going to be. Or it can actually happen if it's like something as security unintensive as buying a potato chips or spending like 50 cents, that can actually happen like on top of like even centralized or semi-centralized like wallet services, exchanges, etc., that are themselves built on top of the decentralized base, right? So depending on the use case, you need more and more, more or less decentralization. If you are like a billionaire refugee running from war and you need to send your $1 billion from Brazil to Mongolia, then you are going to be using layer one, right? But if you were just trying to like play $1 poker, you can use like layer two, right? And so technically the additional layers that are built on top of Bitcoin can allow for orders of magnitude larger scaling. So I believe the entire world can be onboarded, and even like crazy microtransaction stuff will be workable as well. Hmm.
So then who is Bitcoin competing against?
Bitcoin is competing against the US dollar, and it's competing against other cryptocurrencies. And obviously, like we discussed, it's also competing against other investment asset classes, which have absorbed some of the moneyness or monetary premium in the last few decades.
And is the 21 million limit credible?
That's kind of like the most controversial discussion in Bitcoin right now. So like the black pill here is the original vision. And like, I remember these discussions with people like as early as like 2016, personally, at least for me, is that as we reach an era where the block reward is smaller, then the miners would have to rely on hefty transaction fee revenues in order to keep the system safe. I guess on one hand, the question is like how much proof of work is enough to keep the system sustainably safe, could already be enough as is, you know, could maybe even, maybe we need more to be safe. Maybe we need less to be safe, but essentially the current worry, or actually like the current biggest criticism of Bitcoin at the moment, is the fact that they promised like some of the early Bitcoin visionaries promised that the block reward will be replaced by transaction fee as the core revenue generator for miners, but that's not happening yet. And the reason it's not happening, and this is kind of the black pill, is like the other cryptocurrencies, their existence is what's causing the fee revenue to not develop on Bitcoin. Like that's probably something that Bitcoiners don't want to hear, right? But it's like if all of these like casino games and NFT trading and all of that stuff happened on top of Bitcoin, then the fee generation would be there, right? But because Solana overtook the Perp DEX market and the Ethereum layer 2s overtook like the NFT trading, for example, right? And the other like chain X overtook use case Y, they stole the fundamental markets and niches of the market, which could lead to the non-block reward transaction fee revenue generation, right? And because those activities happen on other chains, the main usage of Bitcoin is just buying it and holding it. And if you just buy it and hold it, that's good for the store of value component, right? But it's bad for the transaction generation stuff.
The throughput, right? And velocity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we need to understand that Bitcoin is not just 21 units in a vacuum. It's like a machine, right? It's both a money and a technology. And so these things are definitely something to think about. Now, this is probably a little early. Some of like the crazy like anti-Bitcoiners think that like 11, 12 years from now is when this issue will already become pronounced. More realistic scenario, more like 20, 30 years is when something like this will be important to kind of consider. But definitely something that the Bitcoin community will have to decide one way or another regardless. Now, personally, it would be great to figure out some way to not be change the $21 million limit, right? Because to me, growing up in like the Bitcoin space, essentially, that was the biggest selling point. The biggest selling point was the rigidity of the final supply. And it's like the sexiest thing about it, right? But yeah, essentially, this is a problem that needs to be solved.
Yeah, I can see what you're talking about in the short term. I do think over the long term, Bitcoin and the other layers will subsume the utility that we might be seeing in the short term happening elsewhere. I think over time, Lightning and Layer 3 and Layer 4 will kind of take on those use cases, and or the money and the final settlement layer will be big enough without that, and we might not even need the noise. I think, like you said, though, either way, we got 20, 30 years to kind of see how that plays out. What about hard forks and sort of Bitcoin Cash, 21 million Bitcoin Cash? Is that a dilution of my Bitcoin, whatever sats I have?
I don't think so. That's just another altcoin to me.
Yeah. And what about Satoshi? Is his identity important? And who do you think Satoshi is?
I think it's important for the health of Bitcoin that his identity remain a secret as long as possible, ideally forever. It's really one of the greatest advantages that Bitcoin has, among other things, on other projects. Makes it more decentralized, reduces the cult of personality, and really gives it that mystique.
What would happen if Satoshi's coins moved?
I think the price would drop a bit, but it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Do you think he'd have a chance of he or she or they have a chance of living much longer after that?
I mean, depending on how well he hid his anonymity, he could still live, you know. It would be a lot of money, though.
Right.
A million coins, I believe.
More or less, yeah, something like that is what we think. How do you think central banks should be thinking about Bitcoin?
The super smart ones should be buying some.
Okay, so what happens if a central bank, like even the U.S., tried to buy 5 or 10% of the total Bitcoin supply?
So I promised, I I promise. I promised myself to never really get involved in government in any capacity, really. Mm-hmm. But I always respected independent entrepreneurship a lot more. But if I was close to any central banking decision makers, or to be more precise, sovereign wealth fund managers, which in some countries are one and the same, in some countries they're separate entities, the smartest thing to do would be to allocate 5% at least, or 2% at least, of your balance sheet to BTC and do it extremely slowly, extremely carefully, through a wide spider web of third parties and random individuals and random OTC buys and algorithmic TWAPs and all of that. The game theory about it is actually crazy, because as soon as the first one announces something like this, then the dominoes will fall. Obviously, you can make the argument that El Salvador already did something like this. And it might very well be the very first domino. But obviously, we need somebody from the developed world. And I believe that what's going on is that obviously, like, the large bank, commercial banks and central banks, and obviously the governments, the latter are all puppets of the former, and they're obviously all working together to preserve the current fiat system, right? So, but eventually, we need to understand, and I believe a lot of Bitcoiners have talked about this on many podcasts over the years, we need to understand that there's a difference between like an individual human and their motivations and like them caring about like their offspring and stuff like that, and kind of like the entity they represent, right? And certain things that might benefit you as an individual selfishly can be different from the thing that might benefit your bank or your country or your fund or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so the realistic way that this will happen is it will start with individuals first, but as soon as one of the more notable and important central banks starts to officially allocate to cryptocurrencies, then it will be over. And I actually think that the probability of them having already done that or being in the process of doing so are pretty high. Because if it's happening, it would have to happen quietly, because it would cause a lot of like drama, essentially, right? And so I know for a fact that the boards of certain central banks are people that aren't 80 years old, but more like people like 40, 50 years old. And so those people are like more in touch with like computers and stuff. And so because of that, they're seeing where things are going. You know what I mean? They understand where financial technology is moving. And so it's just inevitable, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. It might be like a fringe country like El Salvador first, but the next one you hear about is going to be bigger than El Salvador. And the one that you hear about after that is going to be bigger and bigger and bigger, et cetera. Now, everybody's like, oh, MicroStrategy, El Salvador, they're fools. And they always say that at the bottom of bear markets, right? But whenever the next bull market comes and the price trades at above the average entry of both Bukele and Saylor, then people will suddenly start calling them geniuses again. It's just human nature.
Sure. Yeah, I know what you mean. I joke around at 50,000, our families will start talking to us again, and at 100,000 Bitcoin, they'll think we're geniuses again. What kind of people do you think will propel Bitcoin's price forward? Do you think it's going to be plumbers and accountants and engineers and lawyers and teachers, or is it going to be dictators and politicians?
Yeah, so high net worth individuals, number one driver, I think. Because the beauty of Bitcoin, for the longest time, I thought the 21 million supply is like the greatest thing about it. But actually, I think the greatest thing about it is its unconfiscatability. And you can essentially like go through the airport with like billions of it in your brain, which is just the most amazing thing ever. It's just so beautiful, right? And I think more and more wealthy people will start realizing that and start parking cash there. I know of dozens already who do. And I think that number will grow. I think politicians themselves who are closer to the roots of the fiat system and see when it's weakening, why it's weakening, that it's weakening, etc., are themselves, like with their personal cash, are going to be allocating money there as well. But ultimately, the majority of the population are followers, right? It's like the herd mentality. And so whenever they will see that certain celebrities publicly endorse Bitcoin or buy into Bitcoin, they will start following. Because, I mean, the powers that be, like they can't control every human. The world is too chaotic. And certain celebrities and certain powerful individuals will fall through the cracks and people will follow them. So I think they will be like the biggest pushers.
Right. So then do you think Bitcoin will increase or decrease inequality? Wealth inequality.
Yeah. Actually, I think it will increase it. but the beauty of Bitcoin is that it never promised to create an equal world. And I actually think the idea of an equal world is a perverse one, because I don't think that humans are inherently equal. And I think that Bitcoin's promise is to create a vehicle where you can save the fruits of your labor into the future. And if Bitcoin grows, essentially, like the bigger the market cap that Bitcoin grows, the better it will be at achieving that, right? At 10 trillion, it will be even better at doing that than today. And at 50 trillion, it will be even better at doing that than it will be at 10 trillion. And so, yeah, its promise and its purpose is to become somewhere where you can park your money and go to sleep stress-free and not to make the world like a communist utopia or whatever. Now, whether like the world is today is already unequal. One of the 10 reasons for that is because of the Cantillon effect and how certain people are closer to like the early flow spigots of the money or the printing press, right? Essentially, Bitcoin will represent a transfer of wealth from the TradFi bankers to the early Bitcoin investors, right? That's just the reality of it. Now, which of the two worlds will be more unequal, less unequal? I don't know. I mean, the world is already extremely unequal as is today. But yeah, I mean, it will be an unequal world. But that's just the reality of life. Like every market, every planet, every cell, they're all unequal.
Do you think this will be the greatest wealth transfer in the history of humankind? Going from fiat to Bitcoin?
It's going to be the biggest wealth transfer in the last 300 years for sure. Yeah.
You mentioned about a communist utopia. And I look at the world today, and I think the use case for Bitcoin is just sort of screaming at nation states. But I think any state that has its own currency really doesn't have a lot of incentives to actually adopt Bitcoin. Especially, and then I look at some of the, and I don't think the smaller states really, like El Salvador, I don't think they matter on the world stage yet, economically, materiality wise. And they didn't have their own currency, so they didn't give up their current currency. But I look at Russia and China. China obviously doesn't seem to want any part of this for a lot of reasons that are just apparent, I think. Russia, I think, has sort of the biggest use case here. And not the biggest in the world, but a really big one and a big economy and a lot of energy-based commodities and minerals and all of that. So I get they have their own currency, but you know, in this particular environment, I don't see Canada moving to this system either with what just happened with the truckers. I don't see, the Netherlands and, it's really, I think the US and Russia. And I don't know how this plays out, but it doesn't seem like either one of them are actually going to do anything with Bitcoin for real. But We talked a little bit about gold and silver. And I think if you look at sort of the economies and the histories and the civilizations in China and India, you can make an argument that they've suffered greatly because they moved to gold late. And I think there is a huge first mover advantage here where it's, yeah, you might kill your own currency, but if this Bitcoin thing works out in the way we're talking about it, I mean, the opportunity is huge and could solidify sort of, you know, the new golden age and be at the center of that. So do you think anyone's really thinking about this deeply, like a Putin or Biden or any of these world leaders?
Well, Biden definitely no, because part of the reason why America is so strong is because the US dollar is like their product, right?
Right.
I don't think Putin is thinking about that either. The importance of Russia here would be overstated because they have a large land mass, but their economy is smaller than Italy's.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Well, couldn't they make a, you know, huge maybe, I mean, you can kind of look at like maybe MicroStrategy is making a huge play on Bitcoin. You know, as a software company, they're probably only going to get so far, but they have to protect their reserves. That makes sense from a business standpoint. But if you can take your reserves and actually increase the purchasing power of them rather than lose, right? Because that was really the first case was to not lose purchasing power. But if you can gain purchasing power, well, you might, you know, outcompete and be able to buy your competition and maybe be the asset allocator of the future. And so I think having a smaller economy than Italy with sort of things that people want to buy, I think Russia is an interesting use case there, as are a lot of nations.
I think like given what's going on in the world, it probably would be bad. Like as Bitcoiners, I don't know if you want this because
I'm not saying as a Bitcoiner, I'm not saying about Bitcoin. Mm. I'm just saying as just game theory here, right? Sort of like, okay, you know, as a human, you know, I'd like to see everyone have equal opportunity, maybe not equal outcomes, right? But part of equal opportunity might come more from greater wealth than lesser wealth, right? And maybe more a fair way of distributing that wealth via a value-based economy. And so I could see it being a great thing for humanity. There's just so many reasons one of these leaders could adopt it and transform their people, their country, their nation state. I'm not saying I'm a fan of this nation state or that nation state or anything, but you know, it could be a huge thing for humanity and a step forward. Could transform their society. Maybe they could leapfrog an economy that's bigger than theirs, and they don't produce as much.
No. Yeah. It's like whenever you hear like Iran, North Korea, or Russia involved in either Bitcoin or DeFi or crypto in any way, it's like, it's just bad headlines. You know, we would much rather prefer somewhere like Singapore or Switzerland or South Korea allocating 1% of their balance sheet to it, right? That would be truly like the big step for sure. Yeah. Because I mean, if Russia does anything Bitcoin related, then the attacks on Bitcoin will just intensify.
Oh, they would, I could see that being a part of a huge attack. Yeah. I think a country like North Korea, I have a feeling whatever they're involved in Bitcoin and crypto, I think it's to sell so that they can fund things. I don't think it's to save in. Right.
And I don't know to what extent you're familiar with the Ethereum ecosystem, but there's a joke that DeFi was the biggest wealth transfer between the West to North Korea. Because, I mean, it is like a lot of the security firms, they estimate that the North Koreans are like the hackers behind some of the biggest attacks on all of the other chains.
And if they are, but I just think that whoever's doing the hacks, I don't, in that case, North Korea, I think they're selling it. I don't think they're holding it. I don't think they're hacking to hold.
I do believe they're hacking to hold. I believe they're hacking to hold because there's nothing else they can hold.
Mm.
I mean,
but what else can they sell too? You know,
so North Korean entities I believe they do have bank accounts in China, and even a few of them in Europe or whatever. But it's not like they have easy access to foreign financial markets, right? They can't invest in bonds, stocks. Where can they hold the dollars other than cash, right? And if they hold dollars through a web of like 16 chains of Caribbean companies at some no-name bank, if that situation ever, if they ever get found out, then that's it, right? So actually, I actually believe they are holding it as a store of value because they simply don't have a choice.
It's interesting. Fair enough. Yeah. Do you think maybe China has a stack then?
For the longest time, I thought they did, but the fact that they banned all mining really, really makes me doubt my previous assertions. Because if they were truly like 150 IQ on this, they would keep the mining or expand the mining rather than ban. But yeah, China has its own domestic authoritarian things going on, so they have their own beasts that they're fighting. So to speak.
What about a country like Venezuela? Who was, you know, they launched their own coin. They're oil rich. They were confiscating a lot of mining rigs in the country. You could argue, you know, do you think they would be mining Bitcoin or accumulating Bitcoin or any crypto to hold?
Yeah, so I don't know those governments per se, but like whenever you meet Venezuelan people in Europe or Turkish people in Europe from Turkey and people, essentially, if you ever meet people from countries where DPEGs or hyperinflations have occurred in like the last 20 years, those people are a lot more likely to know what Bitcoin is because that's the use case it's for. You know what I mean? And those are essentially like small glimpses. See, here's the interesting thing. Throughout the last 200 years, we've had hyperinflations here and there, Zimbabwe, Weimar Republic, et cetera, et cetera. But we've never had it at a global scale. And the reason for that is because we never had an economy of a global scale until today, right? Today, we're so interconnected, both in terms of trading and the internet and imports, exports, everything, right? The banking system interconnected 1,000 times over. So we've had local inflations. We've never had global ones. And essentially, Bitcoin's hope is that it will be there to absorb all of that like a sponge whenever that global collapse happens, right?
Right.
And so that's what we're patiently, not patiently waiting for, but like that's what like it's there to serve as an insurance for.
Sure. Do you think it's even possible for a nation state to hold Bitcoin and not have the potential outcome of that person or family who rules the country running off with the Bitcoin in terms of, I mean, what are they going to do to hold this? Put it in a 3 of 5 multi-sig? And how do you know three people don't work together?
I mean, Nayib Bukele did it, right? So
I don't know where his coins are. I don't know if they're at Coinbase. I don't know if they're in his rig. I don't know if they're in the country's system. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. And whatever the situation is now, I have no idea what the outcome of that can be in whatever amount of time, you know.
We can only hope that the OGs at El Zonte gave them good cold storage advice.
Sure. And, you know, if I'm a nation state perspective, I think that that'd be something really difficult to achieve. I'm not sure how that works. What would be your 60-second elevator pitch to a world leader? To get them to put Bitcoin on, you know, their sovereign fund.
So the dominance of the US dollar will eventually wane, and that will definitely happen during our lifetime. You don't have to exchange everything, 100% of all your assets into Bitcoin, but putting 2-5% of your portfolio to serve as an insurance in case a global financial monetary reset does end up happening is extremely smart. I mean, any kind of game theory expert or economist expert or portfolio allocation expert will tell you that this is the optimal way to think about it in terms of capital allocation. And so besides it acting as an insurance due to its size compared to the current size of the dominant money, its room to grow is so much bigger. Even if it doesn't replace it completely, it can still increase by an order of magnitude from where it is today. So it's definitely the smartest play, the smartest asset class to add to your portfolio today.
Right on. And my final question for you then is, if you could orange pill anyone in the world today, who would it be?
You know, it would probably be somebody who is kind of on the verge already, because it's easier than fighting an uphill battle. Mm. So I would probably say it would be either somebody on the Swiss Central Bank Board, or one of the two large Singaporean sovereign wealth funds, although the latter, I believe, are already like investing heavily in the crypto ecosystem overall already. So yeah, it would be one of those guys. I think it's just much better than one of the fringe stays doing it.
All right, I lied. I got one more question. Like, so, I mean, you talk about like these wealth funds who are possibly dabbling, and, you know, you could, I mean, we've seen it with MicroStrategy and Tesla. When they buy, they could tell us they're buying, price could go down. They, it doesn't necessarily just make price go up when they let us know they're going to buy or when they actually do, because they've announced it and they did already. And we've noticed over that period of time, it could even go down. I don't know if it's people not taking self-custody and there's any sort of fractional reserve at the exchanges. I don't, do you think that there's fractional reserves at exchanges? Do you think that there's Bitcoin price suppression maybe around in the futures market or any of these countries that can print money and just lose it against Bitcoin to protect the current system? You know, maybe you could lose $100 billion to protect a $20 trillion economy and ecosystem and petrodollar. I'm not sure. Do you think that there's odd things going on with the Bitcoin price?
I don't think it's being suppressed yet, because I think the hubris of the current monetary leaders makes them still perceive Bitcoin and related technologies as kind of like a toy or a joke still, in my opinion. Furthermore, there would be far easier ways to suppress it than the futures market and stuff like that. I think the weakest link are the fiat on-ramps. So the ability to send money from banks to exchanges, you block that and you block like 80% of the flow. So yeah, I don't want to give them too many ideas there.
Yeah, fair enough. So then just to roll out, what would be your advice to someone, you know, not financial advice, but to think about what Bitcoin is and the opportunity to hand, and then, you know, definitely leave it to you for any parting words and let people know where they can find your work.
Sorry, can you rephrase that again, please?
How would you sort of frame it up for people? Maybe what is at hand here, or what is at risk, or the value, or you know how it plays risk geopolitically or whatever. How do you think that people should kind of think about this as they walk away from this conversation? In terms of Bitcoin and maybe its future value and being the future of money. And then, you know, any parting words or, you know, and definitely let people know where they can find you and your work.
I think just start off by putting 1%, honestly, less than 1% of your portfolio, your assets, your cash, whatever it is, into BTC. And as soon as you do that, what happens to most people is they start actually learning a lot more about what it is they bought, why it's important, the nature of money, the origin of money, and the kind of the current, like the latest contemporary monetary history, etc. And what's at stake is both your survival, as well as potential financial upside, as well as kind of being able to adapt to the coming changes in the monetary regime, right? Now, obviously, Bitcoiners have been talking about this hyper-Bitcoinization and Bitcoin taking over for a long time now, but Bitcoin has only existed for about 13 years. 13 years really is not that long for, like, in the grand scheme of space, in the grand scheme of human civilization. But in those 13 years, Bitcoin has already surpassed, like, trillions of dollars of essentially its price tag, right? Its market cap. And that's a giant achievement. Now, with every passing minute that it doesn't break, and with every additional user that it onboards, if this is what we achieved in 13 years, imagine where it's going to be at year 25, year 35, etc. Right? I believe it's going to be bigger than where it is today. And so, learn about what it is you're holding now. Learn about how, like, what currency technologies are emerging right now, and make sure that you are on the right side of history.
Murad, this has been so dope. This has been really a thrill to chat with you and to kind of hear the ultimate argument for Bitcoin. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, for sure, man. Thank you so much for having me.
This episode with Murad Mamadov was powered by CipherSafe and CrowdHealth. Please support our amazing Bitcoin-focused sponsors. Drop a dope 5-star review on your podcast app wherever you listen, and share the show and favorite episodes with your friends and family. Stack sats, stay humble, and thank you for listening. This is Cedric. Peace.